Greetings, humans, living and dying in the Anthropocene. This is Jamming Their Transmission, where rebels, freaks, critics, dissidents, iconoclasts, and oddballs live. I'm your fellow traveler, John Madero. This is Jamming Their Transmission. I'm John Madera. In today's episode, I interview Professor Richard D. Wolff, who is Professor of Economics Emeritus, University of Massachusetts Amherst, where he taught economics from 1973 to 2008. He is currently a visiting professor in the Graduate Program in International Affairs of the New School, New York City. He's the author of many books, including Capitalism Hits the Fan, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown, Understanding Marxism, and Understanding Socialism. His recent work has concentrated on analyzing the causes of and offering alternative solutions to the current global economic crisis. I began my conversation with Professor Wolff with the following comments and questions. Among the first things to disintegrate in culture, in political discourse, etc., is meaning, language, etc. Words like freedom and truth and revolution have been diluted to the point of meaninglessness. So let's start with defining terms, even basic ones. Professor Richard D. Wolff, what is capitalism? What is neoliberalism?
Okay, but even before I do, let me agree with you that the whole problem of meaning is more acute perhaps now than ever, at least in my experience. But I believe very much that the capitalism I'm about to define for you is itself a major cause or contributor to the distortions and diffusions of meaning and the inability to get beyond the chaos of what things mean. And maybe we can revisit that topic at some point if it were of interest to you.
Oh, definitely.
So let's begin with capitalism. I can't think of a word that has had more diffuse, diverse definitions, meanings in people's minds and in their usages, written, verbal, than this word. I'm going to give you the definition that I use. It is not the only one, and this is a contested issue, at least for those people who know enough to recognize that there are multiple different definitions. So here's my definition. It is an economic system, capitalism is, first and foremost. By that I mean the way society organizes, the systematic organization of the production and distribution of goods and services upon which society and our very lives depend. So that's the definition. It is a kind of a system for organizing, or it's how we organize, the production and distribution of goods and services. Capitalism is one of a variety of ways of doing that. And to get to the clear definition, let me begin, this is very Hegelian, by telling you what capitalism is not. All right, so here we go. Capitalism is a different system, economic system, than slavery. Why? Because slavery's basic organization of the production and distribution of goods and services arranges people into two connected categories, master and slave. It arranges the relationship between them such that the slave is property of the master, alongside the horse and the plow and the land and everything else. Slavery arranges that the relationship of master to slave is the core way production gets done and distribution gets done. Let me give you a second non-capitalist economic system, feudalism. Feudalism is characterized by the absence of slavery. In feudalism, nobody is the property of anybody else. However, the relationship is one, at least in Europe, characterized by a lord and a serf. And they are the analogs, if you like, the parallels to master and slave. The serf has all kinds of obligations to the lord and vice versa. But they are not the obligations of a slave to a master, neither is the property of the other. And now we come to capitalism. Capitalism is an economic system, a way of organizing production, distribution of goods and services. It also divides the people who are engaged in production and distribution into two groups. In that way, it's like slavery and feudalism. But it is different because the two groups are employer and employee. These are not slaves. Neither of those is a slave of the other. And neither of them owes any fundamental obligation to the other. Any obligations between them must be freely entered into in the form of an agreement, we usually call it a contract, in which the employer promises to do X, Y, and Z, and the employee in return promises to do A, B, and C for a payment from the employer to the employee known as a wage or salary. What these three economic systems have in common is that the master, the lord, and the employer represent a small minority of the population, whereas the slaves, the serfs, and the employees are the majority in each enterprise and usually in the society as a whole. It is also the case that they are similar in the sense that the small minority, master, lord, employer, have the dominant wealth and the dominant power, political power, and they are the leaders of the cultural life of the society, whereas the mass, the slaves, the serfs, the employees, are mostly order takers, mostly followers, etc., etc. Capitalism is therefore really quite like slavery and feudalism, and that would be more widely understood were it not for a peculiar historical fact. Each of these systems eventually died. Well, I can't say that about capitalism. We'll hold that for a moment. But slavery passed away. Feudalism passed away. Other economic systems that I could mention have been born, evolved over time, and then died. And the death of an economic system is usually a difficult, painful, and often revolutionary process. Slavery was overthrown with a revolution. Feudalism was overthrown. And here comes the story with which I'll end. Feudalism was overthrown first in England in the 17th century, and then in France and the United States in the 18th century. British Revolution, French Revolution, American Revolution. Each of those revolutions was very bloody, very violent. In the course of the revolutions in France and America and England, it was declared by the enemies of the existing system at the time, feudalism, that the transition to a new and better system, which we now call capitalism, they didn't use that word, but we do, that the transition to a new and different system would bring with it, here we go now, in the words of the French Revolution, liberty, equality, fraternity. More in the language of the American Revolution, democracy. Capitalism would be a new economic system that brought with it, that was linked together like Siamese twins, to liberty, equality, fraternity, and democracy. And the history of capitalism, from the time it displaces feudalism, in Europe we count that the 17th, 18th century, and then in the three centuries since then, it has become the dominant world system. throughout this history of capitalism, from the 17th to the present century, we have witnessed, those of us that are able to see it and are willing to face it, we have seen an endless demonstration that whatever the merits and demerits of capitalism, the delivery to all of us of liberty, equality, fraternity, and democracy has not happened. The transition to capitalism betrayed in its reality the promises of the revolutionaries who brought it into being out of the defeat of feudalism. And so for me, it is crucial, as part of the struggle to face up to the implications of what I've just said, that the definition of capitalism be focused on the organization of production and distribution around the employer-employee nexus. Sorry to take so long. One final comment.
Go ahead.
Just to give you an idea, here are a couple of very different definitions. Here's a definition of capitalism. Ready? And you'll find this in the New York Times. A free market system, by which they seem to mean, and I'm a close reader of this stuff, as you can tell, what they seem to mean is an economy in which the interactions among people are to be understood as the interaction of buyer and seller, of people transacting an exchange in a place called the market. Here's another definition, that capitalism is a system of free enterprises, or sometimes free private enterprises. And here the emphasis seems to be on organization of production and distribution, not by some governmental agency, governed and regulated by some governmental bureaucracy, but rather the production and distribution of goods and services by non-state actors, by quote-unquote private citizens who structure, originate, operate private enterprises that carry out production and distribution. Those would be completely different, three different interpretations, each one abstracting something to focus on that is different from what alternative definitions have chosen. And I could go on. I'm not telling you there are only three, but the three that I've just given you are probably the major ones you would encounter if you read the literature.
Thank you. That was wonderful. Would you talk a bit about neoliberalism?
Sure. In the history of capitalism, you find something quite similar to slavery and feudalism. Let me stay with that because you'll see it's illuminating to stay with the parallel. Here's what you see. Let me start with slavery. Were there private citizens who owned slaves who worked to produce and distribute goods and services? Answer is an unqualified yes. Were there governmental bodies in slave societies such that they too owned slaves and they too produced and distributed goods? A king, an emperor, a czar, whatever? And the answer again is a qualified yes. An unqualified yes. Turn next to feudalism, same thing. Is there private feudalism? Yes. Is there state feudalism, where the government owns manors, where serfs work and produce rents and all that? The answer is yes. Interestingly, no one that I'm aware of, from any persuasion, ever thought that a slave society was somehow less of a slave society because the government owned slaves alongside of private citizens. And ditto, nobody ever thought it was any less a feudal society if the king had serfs as well as all the individual private lords had serfs. But here comes a distinction with capitalism. In the history of capitalism, an enormous to-do has been made over the following question. Is the employer who has the employees working under him, is the employer a private citizen, or is the employer a governmental operative, a bureaucrat, a commissioner, an appointee, or whatever you want? This is thought in the history of capitalism to be some stupendously significant difference. It is as emphasized in the story of capitalism as it is ignored in the stories of slavery and feudalism, which ought to have alerted people, but didn't. My argument now for you, and you'll get to the neoliberalism in a moment. My argument is the real problems of capitalism, the fact that it betrays the promises of liberty, equality, fraternity, and democracy, have been sublimated, if you know psychological language. They've been displaced. Instead of saying, gee, what happened? Why did capitalism betray its promise? The presumably sincere promises of, I don't know, Thomas Jefferson or Oliver Cromwell or Robespierre or anyone you want to pick who was involved in the revolutions that overthrew feudalism and brought capitalism, their promises were sincere. They thought that bringing capitalism would bring liberty, equality, fraternity, and democracy. But instead of facing and analyzing and debating why did capitalism fail to do that, what we've had instead is a displacement that somehow capitalism would or could achieve what it has failed to achieve if only the state would butt out, if only the state would not interfere with, constrain, regulate, dominate, tax, whatever words you want, the wonderful private sector. Neoliberalism is one of a variety of terms given to the assertion and the whole structure of argument around the assertion that capitalism would be, could be, the vehicle not only for economic growth and well-being, but for the provision to modern society of liberty, equality, fraternity, and democracy, if you could only strangle the state in the bathtub, get rid of it, make the state as minimal as possible, particularly when it comes to any interference in the decisions of how to produce and how to distribute goods and services. It is a reaction to the history of capitalism, to the history of its failures, the history of its unspeakable wars, including two world wars, etc., etc. It is the attempt, in a way, to rescue capitalism, and this is now, of course, my judgment, rescue capitalism from its own dirty laundry, to imagine a capitalism, because that's what they're doing. A capitalism with no government is a fantasy. There is no example in history of such a thing, and there never was. In fact, government has been crucial to the survival of capitalism, and no better example exists than right now, when we have a collapsed capitalism being kept on life support by trillions of dollars manufactured by one branch of the government, the Treasury, and trillions more manufactured by another branch of the same government, namely the Federal Reserve. So neoliberalism is the attempt to manage, intellectually, ideologically, to manage capitalism's displaced debate over state versus private by an argument that the private is clearly superior and that societies would be better off and more, and this is the language they often use, more genuinely capitalist if only there were no state or a state that was absolutely minimal in terms of economic intervention.
This is Jamming Their Transmission. I'm John Madera. I'm speaking with Professor Richard D. Wolff, who just offered us a brilliant definition of both capitalism and neoliberalism. In recent years, when called upon to define socialism, Bernie Sanders, who in my view was, once again, a dutiful sheepdog for the Democratic Party, always came up short, to say the least. Professor Wolf, your thoughts on Bernie Sanders. Also, how would you define socialism?
Well, you can see right away that my definition of socialism, given what I've told you already about capitalism, is different from Bernie's. Let me preface what I'm about to say so I'm not misunderstood. I believe people like me owe Bernie Sanders an enormous debt. The debt of having been the first one to break into the monopoly of anti-socialist rhetoric, anti-socialist imagery, an ideology that dominated American politics ever since the late 1940s.
Yeah.
He's the first candidate who took the label socialist, didn't run away from it, and like Occupy Wall Street, he therefore took with and for us an enormous step forward. Yes, there are disagreements. I'm going to go into one of them in a minute, but I don't want to be misunderstood. I feel that whatever debates the left has in this country now, our audience is enormously larger. The seriousness with which our arguments are taken enormously greater, in good part because of all the activity in and around Bernie's candidacy. So, having said that, because I don't want to be understood, misunderstood on this, I'm not going to be a Monday morning quarterback and all the rest. All right, having said that, my definition of socialism is an economic system that is fundamentally different, not only from capitalism, but also, to stay with the metaphor, feudalism and slavery. That is, it rejects the dichotomy arrangement. It rejects the notion that in an economic system, a minority has to be in charge, whether that minority is the master in slavery, the lord in feudalism, or the employer in capitalism. It is an argument, a proposal, an image, a vision of an economic system not dichotomized in that way, not split into these two groups. And the way I make that as concretely clear as I know how is to speak at the level of the microeconomy. And I'm going to choose the level of the enterprise, that institution where production and distribution occur. So think in terms of a factory, an office, a store. That's where production and distribution occur. So for me, socialism represents the radical transformation of the organization of an enterprise. It's no longer the slave plantation, the feudal manor, or the capitalist corporation. What's the key difference? Well, it does not have either a master or a slave, nor a lord nor a serf, nor an employer vis-a-vis employees. Instead, the enterprise is to be run as a community, a little mini society. That's why the words communism, socialism, that's what they're all about. The enterprise will be run democratically. What does it mean? Everybody in the enterprise has one vote in reaching majority rule decisions over what the enterprise is going to produce, over the technology to be used, over the geographic location where production occurs, and finally, over the disposition of the output that all of the workers collectively helped to produce. This kind of a reorganization at the base of society, in its economic foundation, represents for me the transition out of slavery, feudalism, and capitalism to something genuinely different from all of them. In the kind of enterprise I'm talking about, the democratic decision includes the decision to hire and fire. It includes the decision who gets paid, how much money for whatever their particular contribution is. It entails the fact that every working person has at least two job descriptions. Number one, the specific task in the division of labor within the enterprise. And number two, equal participation in making all the basic enterprise decisions. What to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the revenues or the output or the profits or whatever you want to say. For me, that is the core transformation into what I would call socialism. Therefore, clearly there's a difference between that definition I've just given you and a whole variety of alternative definitions of socialism. For example, there is what mostly Bernie talked about, which is a enormous increase in the role of the government in making all kinds of rules and regulations, a much more redistributive tax structure, the usual things that are in Europe called social democracy. Here he wanted to call it democratic socialism. It doesn't matter. It's the kind of system that socialists practice in many Western European countries, where socialist parties, so-called, advocate for this sort of thing. There, they leave the enterprise organization pretty much untouched. The enterprise still has employers and employees. In most of these societies, the employers are mostly private, but some are state, and socialists tend to be favorable towards state enterprises where the state is the employer and hires employees alongside the private sector. What makes it socialist for them is the network of government rules and regulations, and the use of those rules and regulations to create a much less inequality than typically characterizes capitalist systems, to reduce the instability of the capitalist business cycle, to create a social safety net, etc., etc. You're familiar with that. Then there's still another definition which says it is never enough, and these were bitter debates among people with different definitions of socialism. It's not enough to rule, to write government rules and regulations, because rules and regulations can be evaded, can be weakened, can be repealed, and the history of capitalism is doing exactly that to virtually every rule and regulation ever imposed on capitalists. They've shown a stunning capability to evade it, to weaken it, and eventually to repeal it. And that, therefore, what has to happen to be socialist in these people's view of the term is that the government no longer simply rule and regulate, that the government take over the enterprise so that we don't have private enterprises anymore, and that the government, in order to make sure its rules and regulations are observed, is in fact the employer in the enterprise, the factory, the office, the store, and thereby can be more assured that its egalitarian, its other objectives are not subverted by a private sector. These kinds of socialists kind of look to the Soviet Union, as I'm sure you know, after the Russian Revolution in 1917, the global socialist movement split. Those who thought that the government should own and operate enterprises tended to support the Soviet Union, which was doing that, and called themselves communists, and the other part of the movement kept the name socialist and have, with exceptions, generally gone in the direction of what Bernie meant by democratic socialism and what Europeans tend to call social democracy. There are still other definitions, but again, I think these are the three big ones. The two latter that I spoke to you really focus on the macro economy, the big picture, what the government is or isn't doing relative to the private sector, whereas the first one, the one that's most persuasive to me, is more micro-focused on the transformation at the base of society. The debates between socialists and communists, for example, throughout the 20th century, were again mostly about how important is the state relative to the private, and you can see the two kinds of socialism disagreed about that. For me, just to give you how stark this is, I am really underwhelmed by being told that the employer in one case is a private citizen and the employer in the other case is a public official. It's the relationship of employer to employee and all that it entails that are my focal interests, not the question of whether the employer is a state official or a private person.
This is Jamming Their Transmission. I'm John Madera. I'm speaking today with Professor Richard D. Wolff, whose Economic Update, a weekly program he hosts, takes on complex economic issues and empowers listeners with information to analyze their own financial situation as well as the economy at large by focusing on the economic dimensions of everyday life, wages, jobs, taxes, debts, and profits. The program explores alternative ways to organize markets and government policies. In other words, I highly recommend Professor Richard D. Wolff's Economic Update, which you can find at democracyatwork.info. Moving on to our conversation, while many people say Trump is completely responsible for everything wrong, I see him as a symptom of the two-party oligarchy plutocracy. I also see him and the GOP generally as a kind of convenient decoy moderates and liberals use to keep us from noticing all the nefarious things they are doing. One such example is the recent passing of so-called stimulus packages that have done little to nothing to alleviate the suffering of the poor and working poor. Your thoughts, Professor Wolff?
Yeah, I agree with what you just said. I would take it perhaps another step.
Mm-hmm.
I think Mr. Trump is a chameleon. That is, he does whatever it is he thinks will advantage him.
Right.
And that doesn't distinguish him from most of the other folks who rise up through the ranks and become the establishments of the Republican and Democratic Party. I see them as making decisions they think are self-serving, careerist, and all the rest. But in fact, what they are doing, which does also boost their own careers, is they're putting their fingers up and seeing which way the wind is blowing. And depending on where the wind is blowing, they then orient themselves and speak that way and write that way and act that way. So I see Mr. Trump as a wonderful sign of what the dominant groups in the society think and what they want. And I think he should not be seen as the cause of hardly anything. He is a straw in the wind.
Mm-hmm.
And by watching the straw, you can maybe figure out where the wind is blowing. But it would be a terrible mistake to think that it's the straw that's blowing the wind rather than the wind that's blowing the straw. So for me, Mr. Trump tells me something about where American capitalism is. Just like looking at Emmanuel Macron in France gives me a clue about that, or Angela Merkel in Germany, or Boris Johnson in England, and so on. So what do I see looking at it that way? I see an American capitalism in very grave difficulty, probably the gravest difficulty in its history. Certainly one of the top two or three moments of frightening possibility. This is a country whose capitalism was on the rise from about the time of the late 17th and century or whatever you want to start it, growing, doing better than it itself expected, being able to revolt against Great Britain and pull that off, not by much, but they did, being able to resolve the deep contradiction between capitalism and slavery that ended up in a devastating civil war, to have industrialization after that, to become with Germany the great challenge of the 19th century to the British Empire, watching the British and the Germans destroy each other in World War I, to become the dominant world power, to solidify that after World War II, and to give it now the last 70 years of superpower dominance. It is a heady history. It is a history in which the only way to keep the capitalist engine going was so successful, you might argue, that it brought in tens of millions of immigrants from around the world who had a much harder life before them where they were, to come to this place where economic success and growth was unparalleled. If you look at the statistics, rough as they are, from 1820 to 1970, the real wages every 10 years grew in the United States. No other capitalism was able to give its working class 150 years of rising real wages. That means not just the money, but if you compare the money wage to the prices that people have to pay, what they could afford to buy grew every decade, even during the Great Depression. So by 1970, the dominance of the United States, it had literally run away with the race, and it was the front horse in everything, and presented itself that way. The only way to get immigrants to keep coming was by raising wages, which they did, and they were able to do because they were so profitable, because they had, you know, taken away the land from the original people they found here and all the rest. If you put all that story together, then the period from the 1970s to the present is a catastrophe. It is the end of the period of ascendancy, the peak, if you like. Not peak oil, not peak this or that, but peak capitalism in America, in the United States. Since 1970, for example, there has been no sustained real wage increase. The real wage increase that characterized America from 1820 to 1970, that bred in this country the notion that every generation lives better than the one before, that there's an American exceptionalism that makes God smile on this country to make prosperity on a scale other people cannot hope for or dream about, which you can learn if you've seen the reaction of people, even to this day, to the kind of American films and the standards of living they display, etc. Then you begin to understand what has happened since the 1970s. Real wages stopped growing. The real wage in the United States today is roughly what it was at the end of the 1970s. That's spectacular. That means what your wages, on average, could afford for you to buy is no greater in 2020 than it was half a century ago in the 1970s. Mm. Now, in fact, the standard of living has risen, but that's not because workers could afford to buy more with their wages. They couldn't. So in order to keep up with this ideological notion that it's somehow the American dream that we are entitled to here, that we will have a rising standard of living, that our kid can go to college, that we can have our own home, we can have a car, we can take a vacation, and all the rest of it, led the American people to do something very bizarre since the 1970s. Number one, to work more hours per year than most other working classes in advanced industrial countries. It was an act of desperation. If the real wage doesn't go up, what you can actually afford with an hour of your work, well, one response is to do more hours, which the American working class did. Not, of course, every person, but looking at the statistics, it's extraordinary. But even more extraordinary, because the families discovered that it wasn't just that Papa took an extra hour or two of work or took a second job, but they began to send the mother out. The 1970s is the beginning of something called women's liberation, which indeed was part of this story, but it's also a story in which the only way for families to get at that American dream, which endless advertisement pushed them to want, was to have the adult woman go out to work. No more stay-at-home mom, that's over. And an entire generation has had to accommodate to that situation. Young people going out to work, elderly going back to work, all of that, even that wasn't enough. And so the second thing that the working class had to do was borrow money on a scale no working class in the history of the world had ever done before. The credit card, the mass credit card, is invented in the 1970s to make all of this possible. Before that, credit cards were businessmen's fate. They were not publicly generally available. Now everybody has half a dozen of these cards, and this is a way to enable everyone to borrow up the wazoo. You borrow for your home, you borrow for your car, you borrow for your credit card, and now the new one of the last 25 years, you borrow to send your kid to college. Only by going into unsustainable debt did the working class not revolt long ago. And Trump, just to turn it back again, Trump is the expression, in part, of the exhaustion of the American working class. The exhaustion, literally, they work too many hours, they work too hard, they work at too high a pace, coupled with unspeakable anxiety. Anxiety because they know what their indebtedness means. You lose your job for a little while, your debts are finished. The anxiety level rising in the American people right now is catastrophic as they contemplate their loss of income while their debts still stare them in the face, etc., etc. Plus, when the women had to go out to work, they developed their own idea of themselves as people that were not willing to play second fiddle to the men, as had been the norm in America. So you're seeing levels of divorce, spouse abuse of all kinds, child abuse, the family, the household is falling apart in this society, the pressures are unbearable, and now, you know, you're done, you've exhausted your credit. The collapse in 2008 was the first clear sign that the level of debt is not sustainable. You cannot keep increasing your debt if the underlying real wage, which is how you're eventually going to have to pay the debt, is going nowhere. That's only a matter of time, not whether, it's just when. And that working class is enraged by this slow and steady, and by now 50-year-old demonstration that the end of economic prosperity, the end of the American dream, the destruction of the middle class, I'm just giving you some of the language in which this is articulated. This is a working class that feels left out, left behind, ignored, disrespected, and all of that's true. All of that is true. That's how they've been treated. That's how capitalism has treated them when its growth period, its ascendancy, was over. And they're very pissed off.
Yeah.
And the political party, the Democratic Party, that represented itself as the party of the working man and woman, the party of the immigrants, the party of the minorities, the party of women, the party of all of that, this party didn't do, if you pardon me, it didn't do shit about all of this. It was better than the Republicans. It didn't do it as badly. It didn't do it as quickly. It didn't do it as harshly. But it did it. You know, it did it. It went along. It either couldn't or wouldn't improve the condition of the working class. It couldn't even slow, it could slow, but it couldn't stop the undermining of the gains that had been achieved in the Great Depression, in the New Deal. And so by that time, by the 2016, I think you had what is reasonable. You had a mass of disaffected working people who were disgusted with the Democratic Party because they had high hopes for it, because they were, in fact, Democrats. And they wanted to give their finger to a Democratic Party that had given its finger to them. I don't think many of them had great illusions about Mr. Trump, but it was a kind of a bitter riposte to the Democrats to vote for him. And so many of them did, as an act of anger, an act of striking out. It's a parallel, if you like, to the British voting for Brexit. You know, disconnecting from Europe has absolutely nothing to do with the dilemma of the British working class. But they are so angry that when the elite that they know run the country said, okay, we'll have a vote, and of course you'll all vote to stay with Europe, they gave them the finger too and voted to leave Europe, condemning themselves in the process to the kinds of abuse that they have, that the same people in this country have condemned themselves through by voting for Mr. Trump. And the election this November will simply hinge on how many of the people who got suckered in to the angry Trump vote will have seen the light and go either vote for Biden holding their nose or sit it out. And that's really going to be the determination. Mr. Biden will simply be waiting for the results, crossing his fingers, because everything else he's doing is all window dressing. It doesn't affect any of this.
Professor Wolf, considering how super PACs and shadowy nonprofits give massive power and control to what I call the corporate death machine, I think of elections as perfunctory acts at best and largely impotent exercises at worst. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I agree, but I guess I look at it a little bit differently. The manipulation of the vote, all of those things are obvious. I believe most Americans know it full well.
Mm-hmm.
There's not much I can add to it, but I would like to take a moment to put it in a certain kind of context. If you allow the total absence of democracy in your economy, and by that again I mean that every enterprise is run by a tiny minority at the top, the owner of the firm, the partners who own it, the board of directors of the major shareholders who own it and who select the board of directors. These are all tiny minorities with all the power. There is no democracy. The decisions made by the board of directors are not accountable to the workers. No vote is taken, no discourse involved. It's an autocracy. When you cross the threshold in a capitalist system into your job at an office factory or a store, you give up all of your democracy. We call ourselves a democracy, but in the place most adults spend most of their lives, 5 out of 7 days of the week, the best hours of the day, they occupy a space which has never been democratically organized from the beginning of this country to the moment that I'm now speaking with you. If you allow that, if you allow a tiny group of people at the top to make all the decisions, you can hardly be surprised if they decide to give the lion's share of the wealth being produced to themselves,
right,
whether it's dividends or huge salary packages for the CEO or capital gains for wealthy people to speculate around on the stock market. I mean, the forms don't matter. It's the outcome that should surprise no one. And when you have that, when you have the kinds of inequalities of wealth and power that our economic capitalism enables and reproduces, then the idea that somehow you could keep the political sphere isolated from all of that, immune to all of that, that's really nonsense. Of course, the more wealth is concentrated in a small number of people, the more those people, the wealthy people, understand their vulnerability in a system of universal suffrage. The mass of people are workers. If they have the majority of the votes, if that's how the political system is set up, then they're going to have to control all of the political institutions. Otherwise, they're at risk that the mass of people will use the power of the vote to undo the results of the economy. A tax will undo all the wealth that Jeffrey Bezos has. He's $150 billion. A tax on wealth that's 100% over the first 50 million, and Mr. Bezos is gone as an icon. It's over. And the majority of people would probably vote for that right now if we proposed it. That's how dangerous this is. Mr. Bezos and the people like him, I can assure you, they know very well they have to control the political party by donations, by making sure their trusted people are the candidates, by having the lobbyists to write the legislation, by controlling the media so that their interpretation of who's a good guy and who's a bad guy is dominant, etc. All of these things have had to build up over time to secure this peculiar arrangement in which a very undemocratic economic system is coexisting with a political system that has universal suffrage and a nominally democratic form. This is a contradiction of modern capitalism that I think is very fundamental to how it works. And now my final point to answer your question. I believe in universal suffrage. I think it was a hard battle to win it. You know the history of efforts to get universal suffrage. You know that they were long and difficult, that the original voting in the United States was a vote only to people who owned property and a good bit of property, that the majority of people in the early votings in New England and elsewhere were excluded from the vote, and nobody thought that was remarkable. You had to fight for the notion of universal suffrage. So I think these are important victories. Are they the solution to our problem? No. Are they democracy? That's a joke. But they are steps that I value. I don't want to lose them, if for no other reason than I want to fight to go beyond them. And if we lose them, we'll have to go back and fight to regain them. And that's a fight I would rather spend on building from what we already have rather than allowing it to lapse.
That leads actually to my final question for you. Okay. Premature calls to, quote unquote, reopen America for things to, quote unquote, go back to normal is distressing for me, to say the least. Normal is what got us here in the first place. And America has never been open, not in the sense of being a truly open society. All of this to say that disaster capitalism has always been de rigueur. Is disaster socialism possible? That is, how can people of conscience take advantage of this moment to promote socialist policies that the population would, in many ways, be likely to accept if we had a functioning democracy? That is, what does authentic opposition, dismantling and building look like?
Well, you know, I would have answered that question very differently a year ago, or 5 years ago, or 10 years ago. So here is my answer, but it is one that is, how should I put it, a work in progress, because we really are living through extraordinary times, and your question can't be answered without taking that into account. So here we go. Much of the faith and the confidence in capitalism that has existed and been built up over the last 200 to 300 years of American history is in the process of being destroyed.
Yes.
It's not socialists that are doing that. It is the system itself, its own dysfunction, its own divisions, its own performance. These are so divisive, so inadequate, that even people who really don't want to see it are seeing it. And if they don't see it themselves, their children, who are forced into it, are explaining it to them. and therefore much of what used to be necessary isn't necessary because, well, let me give you an example. When I began teaching, I was getting my PhD at a prestige institution, Yale University. And so I was teaching students, part of graduate student work at Yale was you would teach undergraduates. So I was teaching undergraduates.
Uh-huh.
And we came to a section on American poverty. So like a good graduate student, I went to where I had learned to go to get the relevant government statistics on the distribution of wealth and income here in the United States. And I got them in a very straightforward way, and I made a graph or two and presented it to my students, who, with a few exceptions, but a majority, didn't believe it. And when I looked at them incredulously, what do you mean you didn't believe it? And then I said, see, here it is. I didn't make this up. Here's the table. Here is the government document. Here it is. And they said, no, the government is making this shit up too.
Yeah.
And I realized I can't explain American poverty. I can't show American poverty to Americans who have spent the 18 or 19 years of their lives at that point without any contact with such a thing, and with an endless display from their parents and their teachers and their ministers and everybody else, that this is not a problem to worry about, this is not a problem that you need to concern yourself with, it barely exists, and when you do find it, it's because people are drug addicts or criminals or something bad, and those are people to be despised. Okay, you know, I get it, it took me a while. I don't have to do anything like that anymore. When I come to the poverty section in the courses I teach, my students are already ahead of me. They can give me stories that they've been through or that their parents have been through. Mm. They know, and they know from their older friends that the job market really sucks,
yeah,
and that they're going to be indebted with their BA, and their BA isn't going to get them anything worth anything. In all of that, they know.
Yeah.
Even those who claim that it isn't true worry about it, because they know somewhere, their boyfriend, their girlfriend told them, etc. All right, so then what does the socialist do? I think at this point, we have two tasks. The first task is to figure out what are the final desperate arguments to sustain capitalism that the defenders of capitalism are now resorting to, desperate as they are in a situation in which, for example, polls in America of young people under the age of 35 indicate that they are 50-50 whether they would prefer to live in socialism or capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a deeply alarming trend. It's been going on now for several years, so it's not a flash in the pan. They're all worried. So we need to criticize the defense arguments that are left.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, it goes back to your second question about neoliberalism,
mm-hmm,
because here come the libertarians who will tell you, yes, yes, capitalism as we have it in America sucks, but that's because it isn't really capitalism,
mm-hmm,
because of the role of the state, da, 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 da. If we only did this and got rid of the state, then everything would be wonderful. Okay, that's one way to defend capitalism. You're not therefore required to defend the capitalism that everybody actually lives in and sees. You can defend what this system could be and should be if you made it even more capitalistic than it already is.
Hmm.
Okay, so that would be, you'd have to go after arguments like that, and you'd have to be, and I don't want this to sound impolite, you have to be able to make real arguments. That is, not arguments of rhetoric and of heated passion. I like rhetoric, I like passion. I much rather have them than not have them. But that's not enough. There has to be some greater clarity that has to be developed and kind of criticism that will really drive home the central point, that what you are experiencing today, whether it's the coronavirus pandemic, or it's the 30 million people unemployed, or fill in the blank, that this is really not a problem of those people, or of that particular institution, or of that particular law, but that this is instead a systemic problem. And the parallel is like in the American Revolution, when you're no longer angry at this or that act by the British Parliament for the American colony, or this or that stamp tax, or this or that intrusion. You've had it. You're not going to fight about this or that anymore. The system as a whole is intolerable. You don't want to be part of Great Britain anymore. You want to have nothing to do with them. You want to be an independent country with all power in the hands of local people, none of it in the hands of King George III. But we have to do something like that. We have to understand that we have to make it a critique of capitalism if we want people to see the solution to the problems they face as system change. Let me give you a very concrete example. Why were there no tests? Why were there too few? Why were there too few masks, gloves, ventilators, ICU units in hospitals, and so on? And the answer that has to be given to people, because they're very interested to know, is that in capitalism, what companies produce, what they put in a warehouse, what they stockpile, is only what's profitable.
Right.
That's how this system works.
Right.
It is not profitable to produce a test, stockpile it wherever the population is, and then wait a few years to see whether and when anyone will want it and pay you for it.
Yeah.
That doesn't work.
Yeah.
Companies are not going to do that. It's not because they don't care or they're greedy or anything else. That's how this system works.
Right.
Profit is what you're in business to get. That's what you learn if you go to business school. You're rewarded if your business is profitable. You're punished if it isn't.
Right.
And nobody gives a damn what your excuses might be.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not profitable to produce those things and stockpile them.
Mm-hmm.
And so nobody did.
Yeah.
First lesson then for when you make this argument, you got to teach people, okay, what's good for capitalism was terrible for public health.
Right.
Therefore, you've got to understand that the claim by people who like capitalism that it's a wonderful system has just been proven wrong.
Yes.
For something as fundamental as the literal survival, or at least the absence of grave illness,
mm-hmm.
for millions of people,
right.
was not prepared for because the system has a higher priority on profit. That has to be hammered down. And then you have to explain, what kind of a government is it if it doesn't come in and say this? Look, our private sector didn't function adequately.
Yeah.
So we, the government, you see, we're going to compensate for the failure of private capitalism
mm-hmm.
to make the country healthy or safe.
Yes.
Well, you can't expect capitalists to put in power in their government that they control people who would say such a thing.
Right.
That would be, they would never let those people get to that point for obvious reasons.
Right.
So the very system crippled the government that might have bailed them out. And by the way, the best example of this is that, of course, it's equally unprofitable to produce a missile or a tank or a rifle or any of those things for the same reason. No company would do it if they had to stockpile it waiting for the next war. That's not how it works. The government does come in, does compensate for the capitalist system by buying at an inflated price whatever it may need for the next war, precisely so that the failing of capitalism doesn't undermine the military. And it's only a testimony to the medical industrial complex that they haven't taken a page from the military industrial complex to get the government to do exactly that. And my guess is that they are right now working on trying to make use of this pandemic to get the government to buy whatever they want to produce whenever they want to at whatever price they charge as soon as possible. When you explain in this way, then you help people see what the connection is between what they're suffering and the system change you're trying to get them to see as a solution. Final, last point. You have to make the socialism attractive. You have to say, here is an alternative that's real. Here's an alternative you could understand.
Yes.
Here's an alternative that's achievable.
Mm-hmm.
And here's an alternative that that really gives you a chance to imagine a better life. And you can't do that, I would argue, with the other two kinds of definition of socialism we talked about before. For good reasons and bad reasons, the image people have of a government-run economic system, whether the government is merely the regulator, as in social democracy, or the owner-operator of industry, as in communist or People's Republic type of economies, those have a very bad reputation, mm-hmm. some of it from the anti-communist mobilization, mm-hmm. some of it well-deserved by the failures of those systems.
Right.
So for whatever reasons, good or bad, those are not attractive models, let's call it, for people looking for an alternative.
Mm-hmm.
In contrast, when we go about, which is what I do, advocating for worker co-ops, and we explain what they are, how they would work, and how they are not relevant to the whole state versus private debate, and we expose why that debate is a distraction, here's at least what we find. Have we persuaded people yet? And I think the honest answer is no, not yet. Some, but it's not what it has to be.
Yeah.
But we have intrigued them. And one of the reasons we've intrigued them is that there's no accumulated counter-argument to what we're saying.
Mm-hmm.
The right wing has been so busy attacking the other kinds of socialism, the communist kind and the social democratic kind, that they haven't worked on. They haven't developed the literature. They haven't developed the spokesperson to argue against worker co-ops.
Right.
And because they can be explained in terms of workplace democracy, they get an audience in the United States and an audience that is at least not yet equipped with much in the way of counter-argument. The success we've had, I think, is due to those factors.
Wonderful. Thanks again, Professor Wolf, and
no,
best
no
wishes.
I'm glad to do it.
This is Jamming Their Transmission. I'm John Madera. I've been speaking with Professor Richard D. Wolf about capitalism, neoliberalism, and socialism, and more. You can find out more about Richard D. Wolf at www.rdwolf.com. That's spelled rdwolff.com. And definitely tune into his program, Economic Update. Thanks again to Professor Wolf. That does it for our show. Thanks for listening to Jamming Their Transmission. I'm John Madera. Until next time, and always, be the strange you wish to see in the world.